Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
And my stuff is recording too. Recording live from FYP Studios East and only a single West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 322 of Registry Matters. Larry, what's up over there, yonder, southwest, midwest, south, whatever, wherever you are?
Well, first, I think you meant 332, not 22.
I'm sorry. You're right. 332. I misspoke. Well, it's been really a really, really long week. I don't know what's going to happen tonight.
So, doing awesome. The weather is beautiful, and I'm ready to be here for hours and hours tonight.
Hours. Okay. Hey, someone left voicemail and asking about how to listen to us live, and I always cover it at the end, and I just want to make sure that you know, head over to registrymatters.co, and there are links on every episode, and that would tell you how to get in on the Discord server, and this particular person was already a patron, and you can then link the things, and it makes it easier on your end, on my end, not on your end, but anyway, head over there, and there's a link to get on the Discord server. And otherwise, you should definitely like, subscribe, press notification bells, use your podcast app, become a patron. Did I miss anything?
I think you covered it.
Stimulus checks. Anywho. And then also, we have a lot of chats, fun chats that go on the Discord server. And we have our own little fun community that you could be a part of if you join on the Discord server. With that said, Larry, what are we doing tonight?
Well, first of all, so everybody can click out that's in live chat, it's just Mr. Gloom and Doom for this episode.
Oh, geez.
Chance is unable to join us, but he thinks he'll be able to return next week. We have a case from the Oklahoma Supreme Court. And also, we'll be looking at a recently filed complaint in the state of Illinois. And it was filed by Mark Weinberg and Adele Nicholas, who are great attorneys that work with us. And we will take some. We could take some audience questions if time permits, but you've already said that based on the length of this, time is not going to permit.
This Oklahoma thing is huge. Like, I kept scrolling and scrolling and scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. But I don't think we're going to have time for anything beyond that. But hey, if you are in chat and you want to ask a question, you've muster that thing together and compose it and send it, and we'll do it. You ready to touch on this Oklahoma thing?
I am, even though I failed to put the name of the case in there, but I'll be looking at that while you're setting it up, and we'll figure out what the name of the case is.
Very good. And this is the Oklahoma Supreme Court that deals with residency restrictions, this case that you put in here. And I got to say, man, since it's from the Oklahoma Supreme Court, I guess it's going to be a fabulous, fabulous win for PFRs, isn't it?
Now, that guess is basically inaccurate, to put it mildly. It was not a win for at all for PFRs.
That's completely surprising to me, considering Oklahoma wanted to put the big freaking skull and crossbones on there if you were a PFR in your driver's license.
So let me give the case first.
Sure.
It's Kelly Patrick Donaldson versus the city of El Reno. And it's from the Oklahoma Supreme Court. I don't think any more information is necessary, but that's what the case name is.
And that's El Reno, R-E-N-O, just like the city in Nevada, right?
Correct.
Okay. And this is Kelly Patrick Donaldson was charged with first-degree bad activity in violation of 21 OS Oklahoma statute. That's got to be what it is. Woohoo! I'm going to learn these acronyms eventually. And that's from 2001, subsection 1114A1 in Woodward County District Court. At the time of the commission of the crime, Donaldson was 25 years old and the victim was under the age of 14. On April 20th, 2005, Donaldson pled guilty to second degree bad activity. Donaldson was sentenced to 15 years in prison. All but the first 6 years were suspended. And as a result of his conviction, he became subject to the provisions of SORA. Donaldson was designated as an aggravated offender and is required to register and comply with the provisions of SORA for how long, Larry? For his entire life. When Donaldson was convicted and became subject to SORA in 2005, SORA did not prohibit PFRs from residing near parks. The Oklahoma legislature subsequently amended the law to prohibit PFRs from residing within 2,000 feet of a city park. This is clearly a no-brainer that this violates ex post facto clause.
Not so fast. Remember that the ex post facto clause only applies to criminal laws. PFR registration is a civil, non-punitive regulatory scheme.
I don't think we've ever done two of those laugh tracks in one show, Larry. And I really, really hate that one. But, all right. And if you go watch The Untouchables, there was, I have no idea, I don't remember the woman's name, but she had committed a crime, whatever, and then she was like, this is the last day I'm going to be able to take my kid to a park. Because they had changed the law on her. You say it's a civil regulatory scheme. Ha! Funny, funny. And so nonetheless, the defendant, city of El Reno, appealed from the trial court's entry of a declaratory judgment that applying the current residency restrictions to Donaldson violates the ex post facto clause of the federal and state constitutions, and that the version of SORA in the effect on the date of his conviction applies. So, does that mean the trial court got it right?
They did, but trial courts do not have the final say.
The Oklahoma Supreme Court stated, Title 57, subsection 590 of the PFR Act, or SORA, prohibits PFRs from residing within a 2,000-foot, good that grief, that's a long radius, 2,000-foot radius of a city park and certain other locations. The issue presented is whether applying the current residency restrictions to a person who became subject to SORA prior to the enactment or amendment of the law violates the ex post facto clause of either the United States Constitution or the Oklahoma Constitution. We hold it does not. The current residency restrictions apply to all PFRs, regardless of when they became subject to the provisions of SORA. Now, can you admit that this is legally wrong?
No, I cannot, in view of the evidence that's presented, or not presented, I should say, the evidence that was not presented.
But that was another one of those muddy, clear as mud sentences.
Well, you need evidence, and the evidence that would have won the case was not presented. So that's what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, before we go any further, I noticed in my 43 times that I read it, Donaldson was initially released from prison and began registering 2007. He was arrested again. You know, this is going to be what messes him up, is the arrested again. On June 15th, 2009, and charged with plotting to murder his probation officer. I gotta think, Larry, that when you go in for some kind of hearing and saying, I would like to reduce my level or something like that, and they go, you attempted to murder your PO. They're gonna go, no, you're not gonna get re-leveled. I'm just thinking. Sounds like something that you shouldn't do. One of your Larry's rules?
I would tend to agree that murdering a probation officer is not really a sound idea.
All right, well then, in September of 2012, Donaldson pled no contest and was sentenced to 10 years in prison to run concurrently with the sentence on the previous conviction. Now, did I interpret and read that correctly?
You did. The District Court of Woodward County amazingly revoked Donaldson's suspended sentence on the rape conviction, and Donaldson was released in prison on or around December 21st, 2015. Because remember, they ran the attempted murder or the PO concurrent, and which time he registered and moved into an apartment in Oklahoma City at that particular point in 2015.
Now let's move on. On December 17th of 2021, so just a couple years ago, Donaldson inquired with the El Reno Police Department whether he could live at a residence in El Reno, Oklahoma. El Reno Police Department advised him that he could not reside on the property because the law prohibits PFRs from residing within a 2,000-foot radius of a city park. And the property was located 310 feet from Lake El Reno, which the city of El Reno contends is a park owned, operated, and maintained by the city. Tell us what happened next.
Well, despite the El Reno Police Department's admonition, Donaldson purchased the property anyway. He then filed the underlying action against the city, seeking a declaratory judgment that applying the 2019 version of residence restrictions to him violated the ex post facto clauses in Article 1, Section 10 of the United States Constitution, and Article 2, Section 15 of the Oklahoma Constitution.
And at least he filed the correct type of proceeding. I've heard you pontificate for years that people should file a petition for declaratory judgment. And but he did that. So what went wrong? Let me guess. It was summary judgment.
How on earth did you guess?
Because that is pretty much like if you had like a dartboard, every time something goes wrong, you'd throw one over there and you'd have a whole dartboard full of people trying to file summary judgment.
Well, according to the opinion, it says, quote, the parties filed competing motions for summary judgment. Donaldson argued that the law in effect on the date of the conviction applied, and on April 20th, 2025, SORA did not prohibit registered PFRs from residing within 2,000 feet of a park. At that time, Section 590 only prohibited living within a 2,000-foot radius of any public or private school, site, or educational institution. The Oklahoma legislature amended SORA 1 year later to prohibit PFRs from residing within 2,000 feet of a park.
Now, to me, that seems like a rational argument. Donaldson's position was that because the Oklahoma Supreme Court in Starkey versus Oklahoma Department of Corrections determined SORA's effects were punitive, subsequent amendments to the residency restrictions retroactively imposed or increased his punishment in violation of the ban on ex post facto laws. And you can see Starkey versus Oklahoma Department of Corrections from 2013, and a whole bunch of citations. Now that seems solid to me.
Well, it obviously did to the attorneys as well, but the city of El Reno argued that Starkey did not decide the constitutionality of residency restrictions. The city contended that the residency restrictions were non-punitive civil regulations and therefore applying the current law to persons who became subject to SORA after their effective date of the amendments did not violate the ex post facto clause of either the federal or state constitution.
Donaldson further argued that even if the court found the current residency restrictions applied to him, Lake El Reno is not a quote-unquote park for purposes of the PFR law. The city argued that it was undisputed that Donaldson's property was located approximately 310 feet of the nearest property line of Lake Reno, and that Lake El Reno constitutes a park for purposes of the PFR law. That sounds like one person saying it is and one person saying it isn't. So what is the compelling argument?
Well, that was not a compelling argument. The trial court granted summary judgment to Donaldson. The trial court concluded the residence restrictions were so punitive in nature that applying the 2019 version to Donaldson would violate both the federal and state prohibitions against ex post facto laws. And they were relying on Starkey and a case called Graham versus Carrington Place Property Owners Association from 2019. The trial court found the version of law in effect at the time of Donaldson's conviction controlled, and on April 20, 2005, SORA did not prohibit offenders from residing within 2,000 feet of a city park. The trial court found that because the residence restrictions did not apply to Donaldson, the issue of whether Lake El Reno was a park was moot and not relevant.
Now the city appealed, right?
Right.
All right. This court granted Donaldson's motion to retain the appeal and ordered additional briefing. The Oklahoma Attorney General intervened in the appeal, and the Oklahoma Municipal League was permitted to file a brief as amicus, oh boy, curiae?
Curiae, yes.
Curiae. Oral arguments were heard by the court en banc on November 30th of 2023. Now, wow, this case has been going on for, like, a long time.
That's not uncommon at all for these cases to drag on for years and years.
What is the standard of review in this kind of case? Is there a difference to the trial court's decision?
The constitutionality of a statute, the construction application of a statute, or questions of law, and they're reviewed de novo. So in exercise in de novo review, quote, this court possesses plenary, independent, and non-deferential authority to examine issues presented. When determining the constitution of a statute, courts are guided by well-established principles and a heavy burden cast on those challenging a legislative enactment to show unconstitutionality. Listen carefully. Legislative enactments are presumed to be constitutional. The party seeking a ruling that a statute is unconstitutional has the burden to show it is clearly, palpably, and plainly inconsistent with the Constitution. Now, what do you need to show that? You need evidence.
What? I'm sorry, what?
Evidence.
I got to have a conversation with you about evidence of things unrelated to legalese, even. All right, but so back to this, though. So you've got me all confused, though. The prohibitions on ex post facto law bar the enactment of any law which, one, retroactively imposes punishment for an act that was not punishable when committed. Number two, retroactively increases the punishment for a crime after its commission. Or three, deprives one charged with a crime of a defense that was available at the time of the crime was committed. Now, can you admit that prohibiting a person from living at a location of their own choosing is punitive?
No, I cannot admit that either. Remember, folks, we have to look at this clause as the framers of the Constitution would have viewed the meaning of the words at the time. Nobody alive during colonial times would have thought of a residence restriction prohibition being punishment. Punishment was primarily viewed at the time to be imprisonment or the death penalty. That's what the colonial people living then would have thought about punishment. You do subscribe and believe in the Scalia doctrine of interpretation, don't you?
Only when it serves my purposes. The issue is whether the current version of 57 Oklahoma Statute Section 590A blah 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 applies to Donaldson, a person who is convicted and required to register under SORA prior to the legislature amending the statute to prohibit offenders from living within a 2,000-foot radius of a park. The court noted, "We begin by looking at the statutory language to determine whether the legislature even intended for the amendments to apply retroactively to persons required to register prior to the new restrictions going into effect. If it did not, the analysis ends there. The ex post facto clause prohibits retroactively imposing or increasing punishment. If the legislature intended for the amended residency restrictions to apply only prospectively to offenders required to register on or after the amendment's effective date, there can be no ex post facto issue. But if the legislature intended that the new residency restrictions also apply to offenders who are required to register prior to the effective date of the amendment, an ex post facto analysis is warranted at that point." Was the analysis warranted here?
Yes, it was. They determined that it was intended to apply to all PFRs, regardless of the date of their offense. The court stated, quote, "We find the legislature intended for the resident restrictions as amended to apply retroactively to offenders who were already required to register prior to the effective date. The legislature did not make an express declaration. However, the legislative intent to give the statute retroactive effect is necessarily implied by the language it used. It is unlawful," this is the language, "for any person required pursuant to the Sex Offenders Registration Act to reside," and they put emphasis added on that. Any sex offender would seem to include all sex offenders, because this would be like the Nebraska Supreme Court. You are a person, right?
I am not. I'm a vegetable.
It says any sex offender.
Since you're very difficult, let's keep moving. The court stated, "The pertinent question then becomes, are the residency restrictions punitive? If the residency restrictions are punitive, the amendment cannot be applied retroactively because the ex post facto clause prohibits retroactively imposing or increasing punishment for a crime. But if the residency restrictions are not punitive, the ex post facto clause is not implicated, and it is within the legislature's discretion to give provisions retroactive effect." How is this determined?
Well, the court stated in Smith versus Doe, and that's the landmark case, 538 U.S. at 84 from 2003, the United States Supreme Court set forth what has become known as the intent effects test for determining whether the retroactive application of PFR registration laws violates the ex post facto constitution, the clause of the United States Constitution. We adopted this test in Starkey versus Oklahoma, and if you don't mind, would you read those? Because too much for me.
All right. Well, so this is the case. This is the Kennedy, Mendoza, Martinez factors. That's what you're talking about?
Correct.
All right. So, they stated, if the legislature intended for the provision to be part of a civil, non-punitive regulatory scheme, we apply the intent effects test to determine whether the civil regulatory provisions is so punitive either in purpose or effect, as to negate their intent. See Smith, and that's 538 U.S. at 92, citing Kansas versus Hendricks, and on and on. In evaluating the punitive effects of the law, both United States Supreme Court and the Oklahoma Supreme Court consider five of the factors identified in Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez. Here they go. So there are seven of them, but they said they only used five. Did I catch that?
You did, but the Oklahoma Supreme Court uses the other two as well.
Okay, all right. So here are the seven things. Whether the law imposes an affirmative disability or restraint. I'm going to put my own little mental check mark as a yes. Now, whether it has been historically regarded as punishment, I don't know the answer to that one. Whether it is whether its operation promotes the traditional aims of punishment, retribution, or deterrence, whether it has a rational connection to a non-punitive purpose, and then number five, whether it is excessive in relation to this purpose.
And they stated for challenges based on the Oklahoma Constitution, this court considers two additional factors from Mendoza-Martinez. Whether it's incumbent on a finding of scienter, and whether the behavior to which it applies is already a crime.
Would you do me, what is scienter again?
Knowledge.
Okay, so whether you knew it?
Yes.
Okay. And the Starkey case was decided more than a decade ago. Now, can you briefly summarize that case?
Starkey had pled no contest, no will contendere to a sexual assault of a minor child, and received a deferred judgment in Texas in 1988. Starkey entered and intended to remain in Oklahoma in 1998, at which time he became subject to provisions of Oklahoma SORA. When Starkey first became subject to SORA in 1998, he was required to register for 10 years. But in 2004, amendments effectively extended Starkey's registration period to 20 years. Then, you know, they can't stop themselves. They can't help themselves. In 2007 and 2008, the Oklahoma legislature amended SORA by adopting a risk assignment system, which is not exactly what they did, but this is coming from the court. They adopted the categorical approach to aligning offenders based on their crime that applied to all PFRs convicted in Oklahoma and PFRs with convictions in other jurisdictions who choose to move to Oklahoma. Just before Starkey's 10-year period was set to expire, the Oklahoma Department of Corrections assigned him a Level 3, which required him to register for life. The issue in Starkey was whether applying these amendments, which had the effect of extending his registration from 10 years to life retroactively, increased his punishment.
And why did Donaldson not win based on Starkey?
Well, because the issue presented in Starkey is not presented in this appeal. Donaldson admits that at the time of his conviction, the law provided he was designated as an aggravated offender and that he was already required to register for life. Donaldson does not contend that subsequent amendments to the residency restrictions extended his registration period. And that was the issue in Starkey. Everybody wants to always overread these cases and read stuff that's not there. Rather, the issue currently before this court is whether the retroactive application of subsequent amendments, which prohibit offenders from living with 2,000 feet, that's the issue, and whether that is punitive.
And then, so there you go again. Are you dicing words?
No, I'm actually reading directly from the court's decision. They stated, we did not determine in Starkey that residence restrictions and the relevant section or any of the other individual or requirements imposed by SORA were punitive and violated the ex post facto clause. The Starkey court emphasized that, quote, our scope is focused on the constitutionality of retroactively extending SORA registration. Attorneys, if you had read that decision, you wouldn't have decided to hang your hat on it. Having found that SORA's effects to be punitive, we find that the retroactive extension of registration periods violates the prohibition on ex post facto laws provided in Article 2, Section 15 of the Oklahoma Constitution. Don't read what's not there, folks.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say F-Y-P.
And then paragraph 25 states, Starkey and the date of conviction rule tell us that the law in effect on April 20th of 2005, the date of Donaldson convictions, determines if and for how long Donaldson is subject to SORA. And as discussed above, that is not in dispute. They went on to say in paragraph 25 that Starkey is not dispositive of the issue presented in the case. Whether the statute prohibiting a registered offender from residing within 2,000 feet radius of a city park is punitive. A separate analysis of this specific provision is required. How did that analysis go?
Not very well for Donaldson.
Now let's look at one of your favorite factors, and that's whether the law imposes an affirmative disability or restraint. What did they conclude there?
Well, unlike imprisonment, the paradigmatic affirmative disability or restraint, the residence restrictions do not impose any physical restraints. And they cited Smith versus Stowe. The residence restrictions in Oklahoma law limit where Donaldson can live, but they do not limit where he can go. Nonetheless, limiting where offenders can live imposes a disability of restraint, while minor and indirect are unlikely to have a punitive effect. And they said, we agree with Donaldson that restraints on where a person may reside are significant and direct. We did not reach this conclusion based on evidence that Donaldson and other PFRs cannot procure appropriate housing due to large geographic area being restricted. But they said Donaldson produced no such evidence. Donaldson claims a 50% reduction in housing and that the resident restrictions freeze out offenders from large swaths of communities. However, he has failed to cite any authority or evidence in the record to support his arguments. Now, Andy, you've been listening to this for a long time of what I've been griping about things not being in the record.
Why would he not produce a map with a bunch of circles like Paul Dooling did at the conference, showing all the places that you can't go? 2,000 feet eliminates a whole ton of territory that you could live in. And then you throw in, I'm assuming churches are in that equation as well, because they usually have some kind of park listed in there. You are barred from a whole mess of places.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, so, you said you're barred from a hole, and that's the last thing I heard.
Oh, well, he's barred from a whole mess of places. Why wasn't there any evidence in the record?
Well, there was no trial held to build the evidentiary record. And there are a number of ways to get things in the record. You can have a trial, and a court can hear evidence and admit evidence and weigh the veracity and validity of the evidence. Or you can do requests for admissions. You can do interrogatories, pretrial, and you can file joint stipulations. There's a number of ways to get evidence into the record. But apparently, the state or the city of El Reno wasn't willing to stipulate to any of this stuff, and it was not in the record. That seems to be the problem.
The court stated, rather, we find residents on where one may reside are significant and direct because a person spends a substantial amount of time at his or her residence. Furthermore, a home is not simply a shelter. It is deeply personal and the center of daily living. Personal preference, affordability, and the specific needs of the household determine the type, size, price, style, and location of one's residence. So this factor weighed in favor of finding of punitive?
Yes, and I think you meant restraints above there, but not residence. And it did weigh in favor of that. But perhaps it could have been more compelling had there been evidence in the record.
And is it a form of banishment? Can you admit that?
No, I can't do that either. The court stated the residence restrictions in Oklahoma law do not amount to banishment. The 10th Circuit, which is where Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch served, discussed the history of banishment at length in Shaw versus Patton in 2016, and that was when he was on the court, I think. The cornerstones of banishment are, quote, the complete expulsion from a community and prohibiting offenders from even being present in a restricted area. Remember, folks, we have to interpret the Constitution as the words would have been understood at the time when they put the no banishment clause in there. Banishment at that time meant what I just read. With this deeper understanding of historic punishment of banishment, we find that Soros residency restrictions do not amount to banishment. Section 598 does not expel offenders from entire communities or ban them from being present in city parks or playgrounds or visiting home within the restricted area.
Okay, now I see that. They stated, the Starkey Court recognized as much when it noted that the offender is prohibited from residing on the property, ostensibly allowing a PFR the ability to be at the residence, but not reside on the property. And then Starkey in 2013, and that was, what is that, 1026? Is that that's not the page, is it?
It is, but yeah, it's not okay. Relevant. You got the citation there.
Okay. As the city of Reno points out, 57 Oklahoma Statute 598 does not prohibit Donaldson from recreating or accessing the facilities at Lake Reno. The statute only prevents him from establishing a residence in the restricted areas.
Also, they said, furthermore, Donaldson has not put forth any evidence that the scope of the residence restrictions would effectively prevent him from residing anywhere within the community of El Reno. I wonder why there was no evidence in the record.
Geez, I wonder. All right, well, then the court stated, the punitive effects of the residency restrictions do not clearly outweigh Sora's non-punitive purposes. Considering these factors, we conclude that Donaldson has not presented clear proof that the punitive effects of residency restrictions negates the civil regulatory purposes of preventing PFRs from reoffending and protecting the public. Woohoo! Specifically children. A law that restricts PFRs from residing near places where children congregate, such as a park, furthers these non-punitive purposes. The only factor with significant weight in support of punitive effect is that any limitation on where a person may live imposes an affirmative disability restraint. However, this factor alone does not transform civil regulation into criminal punishment.
They concluded by saying, we hold that prohibiting PFRs from residing within a 2,000-foot radius of a city park does not impose or increase punishment.
There was another question that was mooted at the trial court. Does that matter now?
It does, actually. The question of whether Lake El Reno is a park for purposes of Section 598. In paragraph 47, they stated, quote, because the trial court concluded that the 2019 residence restrictions could not be applied to Donaldson, it did not determine material facts such as whether the subject property located within the 2,000-foot radius was a city park. They didn't make that determination. The trial court found the issues were moot. As a result of this court's holding, these issues are no longer moot. However, an appellate court does not make first instance determinations of disputed facts of either law. In fact, an appellate court does not make first instance determinations of disputed issues of either law or fact in the exercise of our appellate jurisdiction. On remand, the trial court is to determine whether the dispute of a material fact exists as to whether Lake El Reno is a park for purposes of Section 598. And if so, whether the subject property is located within 2,000-foot radius of the property line of the park. Now, they've already stipulated, the parties have agreed that it does fall within 300-something feet, but they have not agreed whether or not it fits the definition.
Isn't that vaguely similar to the whole easement thing with the Butts County Halloween sign on whether that little area, the 10 feet, whatever, off the highway is a county property or not? Isn't it similar?
Very similar.
Very good. So then Donaldson could win?
He could indeed, and it would be funny if he did, because despite sloppy lawyering, he might still win this case if they determine that it's not a park under the law.
Do you have any sort of spidey senses as to whether it would be determined to be a park or not?
Well, there are factors in play here that just really make a person like me go bananas, because I think Oklahoma elects their judges. So the judge has a political consideration to take into account. But also, judges do not like being overturned on appeal. It's very offensive to most trial judges. They do all the work, they listen to the evidence, and they make a decision, and then the people sitting off at a distance overturn them. So it could be, if the judge can find something to hang his hat on, he's not going to just do it to be spiteful, but if he can find something to hang his hat on, he very well could decide that it's not a park and send it back up to the court system again for them to slap him down again. So I would just laugh, because I think it'd be hilarious if he says, well, you won on that one, but you don't win on this one. It is not a park.
Interesting. Well, okay. That was a very long segment. I told you it was a long segment.
I told you so, but it was fun, wasn't it?
That was fabulous. Let's move over to this case that you put in here from Illinois, and it's Illinois Voices for Reform and Joshua Hale, individually and on behalf of those similarly situated plaintiffs, versus Brendan Kelly in his official capacity as director of the Illinois State Police. That's the defendant. This has just been filed, and what is this case about?
It alleges Illinois State Police has no effective process for a registrant to correct erroneous information that appears on the registry website.
And so the complaint states, as a result of the ISP, that's not your internet service provider, that's the Illinois State Police, as a result of their failure to create and implement a process for correcting errors, individuals on the registry have no remedy when they are harmed by errors on the registry. For example, an individual who is mislabeled as a bad, bad PFR on the registry website, then that label does not apply pursuant to the relevant Illinois statute, is unable to challenge or correct that erroneous designation. Likewise, an individual who is erroneously told by a local police that he must register for the rest of his life, when he is only required to register for 10 years pursuant to the relevant Illinois statute, does not have any effective way to seek relief from the burdens of continued registration. This is bad.
Yeah, I think that last sentence you read overstates the situation. You should always have the ability to file a declaratory judgment action. But it is indeed bad. But the legal question is, do the federal courts have jurisdiction to force the state of Illinois to improve their registry website? That's the legal question here. Remember, we don't like these big old bad federal judges that have been appointed for life and accountable to nobody. We don't like them coming here and telling us how to run our states.
I mean, it's another no-brainer. Of course, they have jurisdiction. They created the registry.
Or did they? I'd say the states created the registry in order to procure federal funds.
Do you think that they said, we'll make a registry so we can siphon some funds out of the federal government?
Absolutely. There's not even any question or debate about that.
Huh.
None whatsoever. Right. They were not forced to create a registry. The feds cannot force them. They were told that if you want to create the registry and you want to suck down some money, you can do it. And if you meet these standards, you'll get the money. That's what created the registry. The feds didn't create the registry. The states did.
I see. Fair enough. All right. Plaintiffs allege that the ISP's failure to create and implement an effective process for correcting errors on the registry violates the 14th Amendment, their guarantee of procedural due process. Plaintiffs seek class-wide injunctive and declaratory relief. Now, do you think that this is not a good claim?
I don't know. It's too early to tell, but does one have a right to due process when it comes to information on the public PFR registry? I'm not sure if they do.
I thought you were an advocate for PFRs, Larry. How can you say that they may not have a right to due process?
Well, I can say that because I'm not aware of such a right. Can you cite where that right exists? Now, we do have a form of a right, of a similar right here in a limited way in New Mexico. A PFR has the right not to be listed on the website until certain processes have taken place. However, that's a very limited due process right, and it's only available for non-New Mexico convictions. So during the time that it's being determined, if your conviction is equivalent to one of ours, not substantially similar, but equivalent, you have the right to due process before you're illuminated publicly. But as far as Illinois being required to keep the registry accurate? I'm not sure if any such right exists. It wasn't cited anywhere that I spotted in the complaint that there's such a right to have accurate information. For God's sakes, the NCIC is not accurate. There's a lot of people's criminal histories that are not accurate.
Plaintiff Joshua Hale is a resident of Aurora, Illinois, and is a supporter of Illinois Voices for Reform. Pursuant to the relevant Illinois statute, he is required to register as a PFR for a period of 10 years. However, the registry currently reflects erroneous information regarding his status and registration obligations. Namely, he is falsely labeled as a really bad PFR who is required to register for the rest of his life on the registry website. And this could get him killed, Larry. It sounds like you're almost like minimizing that he doesn't have a right. They could show up on his door and knock on it and then like blow his head off just because of that.
It could indeed, and perhaps he would have a much stronger claim if that happens.
I don't think he's going to be a plaintiff. His head's like splattered across the ground.
But yeah, the claim would be stronger though, wouldn't it?
But who else would have standing except for him? And he wouldn't be standing at that point.
You're sick, right, man. Well, you're sick.
I know. I'm sorry. SORA creates two basic categories of registrants who have different registration obligations and restrictions. There are PFRs and then the bad PFRs. And what category a registrant falls into is determined by the crime of which a person is convicted. And that's CS, Larry?
Ignore all that.
Okay. There's a bunch of numbers and letters all in parentheses and whatnot. And that it sets forth that the conviction that qualifies individuals as PFRs or bad PFRs. Now, that seems pretty straightforward to me, Larry. So this is is that categorical versus static? What is the other one?
You talk about categorical versus risk-based, and this is categorical.
Yes. Right, categorical.
It does. Individuals designated as sex offenders are required to register for a period of 10 years following their conviction or discharge from the Illinois Department of Corrections. Individuals designated as the really bad ones, sexual predators, are required to register for the rest of their natural life.
And, God, I lost my place. All right, since it is illegal for a person designated as a bad PFR to knowingly be present in any public park building or on real property comprising any public park, or to knowingly loiter in a public way within 500 feet of a public park building or real property comprising any park, the PFRs have a viable interest in the listing being accurate.
I agree, because violation of either of these prohibitions is either a Class A misdemeanor or a Class 4 felony for a second or subsequent violation. This restriction does not apply to individuals required to register only as a regular PFR. So absolutely, it has significant if they have you categorized incorrectly.
And then paragraph 37 notes that Plaintiff Hale is currently experiencing significant impairment in his legal rights and reputational harm as a result of the ISP's failure to implement a process for registrants to challenge errors on the registry website. In particular, Plaintiff Hale remains on the ISP's PFR registration website, although his lawful registration period expired 4 months ago. He was required to pay a $100 annual registration fee. He is still erroneously listed as a bad PFR. If he violates any aspect of the Registration Act, including failure to report a change of address, employment, or internet identifiers, he's subject to new felony charges. That is also bad, Larry. However, let me just float this. If he does end up violating that, then when he goes to court, wouldn't a judge determine that he has passed that registration date and it would not proceed?
Well, that would be our hope, but the problem is you have to go to jail.
Yes, I got all that part.
And post bond if you can afford it, and lots of problems go with it, and you can get killed in jail, but yes.
I didn't mean it was easy. I was just thinking that the system would correct itself after it went bad for him.
It's bad for sure. But the question is whether the complaint has been filed in the proper court and whether the complaint frames the issues correctly. The questions raised in this complaint are, has the ISP promulgated adequate procedures to ensure that the information in the database is accurate as required by Illinois law? Why did the ISP discontinue its hotline for reporting registry errors? Has the Illinois State Police provided training to local law enforcement agencies regarding how to respond to a registrant's report that there are errors on the registry? And does it satisfy the demands of due process for the ISP to shift responsibility to local law enforcement to correct errors on the registry? Now, when I looked at those first three of those, I don't see anything that really falls squarely within a federal constitutional claim. So we get down to the last one about due process, and then I didn't see enough in the complaint when I did my read of it to show that there's a due process guaranteed. So the complaint looks a little bit slim so far. And are these constitutional questions? Are they properly in a United States District Court? Time will tell. But right now, I'm having a little bit of hesitation looking at the complaint on its face.
Interesting. You go down to your local registry office and you've passed your 10 years and you tell them that you're done, and they go, yeah, we agree that it's done, but the Illinois Bureau of Investigation, that's the Georgia version, whatever they call it up there, they would go, oh, we can't control it here. It has to be done there.
Yeah, but again, is this a case for a United States District Court to resolve, or is this a case for the Illinois court system? Whether or not you're training officers correctly, is that a federal issue? Taking down the 800 number to call, is that a federal issue? Constitutionally, is that a federal issue? I'm just not sure that I'm buying this. Now, in the liberal days of activist judges that wanted to help criminals, this might be something, but we're in a very different era today in 2025, where courts are not so big on helping people who have committed crimes find ways to help themselves. This is not the Earl Warren era anymore. So I'm looking at this thinking, if this is not any stronger than what I'm seeing here, this may not survive the first round of motions to dismiss.
Interesting. Well, that's not cool, because, again, all the things bad about him being on the registry past his time. It's not quite the same as being in prison past your release date, but it's semi-close.
Well, it doesn't mean that they just wouldn't adjudicate the issue. It doesn't mean that he couldn't seek relief through other means, but I think a declaratory judgment would be the better vehicle than what they're doing here. But like I say, time will tell. This is very early. We haven't heard from the attorneys. This is just my non-attorney view. It came out in the last few days, I became aware of it, and we'll have the attorneys on one or both, and we can figure out if I've missed something here. But at first blush, I'm a little bit pessimistic about this case.
And one other thing before we leave out of this, if he did declaratory judgment, that would impact him. This case is potentially impacting all of them.
That is correct. What they're trying to accomplish is very noble. They're trying to figure out how to stop a problem that's probably statewide and affects dozens, if not hundreds, of people in the state of Illinois. They're trying to figure out a vehicle to make it where they don't have to piecemeal this. That's very logical, yeah. But I'm not sure that going to federal court is the best avenue, but they have the law licenses. I don't. And they had their reason for doing what they did. Time will tell.
Very well. Is there anything else that you would like to cover? Because we are done with all of our content. But I do have something to tell you, Larry.
Is it funny?
Well, it's kind of funny. So a longtime patron, a very nice supporter of ours, generous supporter, my husband just made me a very delicious rye old-fashioned. Yum. We'll take a sip every time Larry says something negative. That was like 20 minutes ago. And now it says, if Larry doesn't stop with this negativity, I may have to order another drink.
Well, how many sips has that been? Can I get a count on that?
That's probably similar to how many licks does it take to get to the inside of a something, whatever that was. Anyway, she said 327.
327.
Not she, somebody else did. Do you want to cover any of these articles real quick?
I didn't prepare.
Very good. No one provided any questions. So we are out of here, man.
It truly was doom and gloom tonight, wasn't it?
Yes, but that's what your picture is up on the screen just right then. You are Mr. Doom and Gloom. Head over to registrymatters.co for show notes, and that's where you can find out how to download the podcast for your particular podcast app. And if you want to leave email, send us an email over at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can join the Discord server. There are links there on the show notes. And that is a fine way to hang out with us and talk about whether it's legal or somebody likes to post all the really bad tweets that go around about people being bad to registry people. Anyway, it's a great place to be. And then we have swag over at the fypeducation.org/shop. We have t-shirts up there and mugs and other things, more stuff coming soon. And without anything else, Larry, I hope you have a fabulous weekend and I hope you stay warm and all that.
Thank you. We'll see you in about a week.
All right, man. Have a good night. Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to FYP.